The foundation of my blog and then my podcast under the Fishnets and Philosophy brand has always been a deep curiosity about the world around me and the people in it. When I first launched the podcast, I felt drawn to a general curiosity about the world and society, akin to what Brené Brown does with her podcast. Talking to specific interesting people or focusing on specific topics such as gender and sexuality. Though I quickly realized that as much as I had a deep interest in these big topics, I was being pulled in a different direction. To analyze and discuss horror films and the genre as a whole. It had dawned on me that the two podcasts I was mostly listening to were What a Scream by my friend Igraine Hacca-Cantabrana and Evolution of Horror by none other than Mike Munzer. And I wanted to alter the direction of Fishnets and Philosophy so it could add my voice and my own perspective to the horror space. However, it was very important to me that I would still approach every episode with the same love for knowledge and curiosity that was the foundation of my earlier episodes. My first foray into the horror space was a retrospective of the Saw franchise, and I am deeply grateful to my friend Ariel Power Shab for helping launch the new direction of my podcast. And then I dipped into a retrospective on the Purge franchise, where I got to have discussions with Rebecca McCallum, Brett Peterson, and also Hannah Ogilvy of Fats on Film. And then I followed that up with a discussion of the Final Destination franchise, where I was able to talk to Kat Hughes, the Drunken Horror Gang, Iona Smith, Sarah Cleaver, and then also Rob from Creepy and Geeky. And all of those were amazing, really fun discussions, and it was really cool to do a full deep dive of each of those franchises and bring my own queer perspective to it. Though, as I stepped further and further into the horror space, I realized that I wanted to do something more than just analyzing horror franchises. There were already podcasts doing that type of show well, and I wanted to do something which would set me apart from those other shows. That was when it hit me that my foundational inquisitive curiosity should be what leads my show, rather than just being a constant presence. Leading with curiosity, I noticed that a common question on most, if not all, horror podcasts was, what was the first horror film you watched? And that was then the concept for my Why Horror series was formulated. Every time a new guest appears on a horror-themed podcast, the host asks them their horror origin story. Because I think what fascinates us horror fans the most is how we fell in love with this genre. That was when I asked myself, why don't I use that as the catalyst for my upcoming season? And thus, why horror was born. This is going to be the closing episode of this season, where I was joined by Mike Munzer, who created Evolution of Horror, And I once again want to express my gratitude to Mike and to every guest I spoke to for this season, because without you, this would not have been half as fun and interesting. I would also like to thank every person who has listened to my podcast and has shared and talked about what I am doing in my little corner of the horror space. I hope you enjoy listening to this final episode, and remember, put on your best fishnet tights and always be curious.
Welcome back to Fishnets and Philosophy. This is your host, Mick Spell Morrigan, and once again, we're jumping into exploring the question, why horror? Where each week, myself and a different guest will try and pick apart this incredibly fun question and topic. This week, I am joined by the incredibly amazing Mike Munster. So, Mike, if you could just introduce yourself, your connection to the horror world, and how people can find your work.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, so thank you for having me. My name's Mike. I do the Evolution of Horror podcast, which is a podcast that kind of looks into the history, as the title suggests, really, looks into the history and the evolution of the genre. It's been running for about 5 years now. Lots and lots of episodes, lots and lots of guests. If you're into horror, come and check us out. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Amazing. And yeah, so the thing before we started recording, I can't imagine anyone doesn't know Evolution of Horror, because it's really shaped so many things within the horror sphere. So very appreciative of you jumping on my little podcast. But no, thank you so much. But I like to kick off each conversation in this series with this first question, because I think every horror fan has their own unique answer to it. And it's just a really good way to get to know where people are approaching horror from. So for yourself, what was the first horror film that you remember watching? And then a kind of addendum to it, because sometimes the answers are different. What was the horror film that made you a fan of horror, that you watched it and you realized, this is my thing?
Yeah, I always say I've got a kind of like two examples, really. Like when I was very, very, very young, I first saw and fell in love with the music video to Michael Jackson's Thriller, which I was sort of obsessed with as a kid, right? Like, I loved Michael Jackson music as a kid. I had older sisters that used to play his stuff. And then when I discovered that music video, I was very young. I would have been about 4 or 5 years old, I think, and it absolutely terrified me, but I sort of became obsessed with it, and I repeatedly wanted to watch it, to the point where my parents bought the VHS that has like the music video on it, followed by the making of doc.
Oh, wow.
And even as like a really young kid, I was sort of obsessed with not just the music video, but everything that followed afterwards on that VHS. So kind of John Landis and Rick Baker talking about like creating the monsters and the makeup and the effects and all that kind of stuff. So that was definitely kind of where my sort of love of horror, I think, began. But first proper horror film, like proper, was Scream, Wes Craven's Scream, 1996. Again, I saw it way younger than I probably should have. I would have been about 11 years old. I had two older siblings who had kind of rented the film from our local video store. They were babysitting me that night. They sent me to bed. They were like, you're not allowed to watch this. It's way too like grown up for you. It's an 18. And I was really gutted because I thought it looked really good from the box. And so I went to bed begrudgingly. And then the next morning, woke up super early, as you do when you're really young. I woke up at like 6 in the morning and no one in my family was awake yet. So I like snuck downstairs, pressed rewind and hit play on the VHS, which was still in the player. And I watched the whole of Scream at like, 6 a.m. on a Saturday morning, like on the sofa. And it absolutely blew my mind. And it was this feeling of particularly with that opening scene with Drew Barrymore, right? That feeling of being incredibly scared, but also sort of exhilarated and wanting more of it and wanting more of that feeling. So that is still to this day one of my all-time favorite movies. I love it. And I actually think it's a really great sort of gateway into the horror genre when you're young, you know, because it's a really fun, poppy film, you know, it's very cool. And also it is scary. Wes Craven takes the horror seriously in that first film, but also it does that thing where it kind of all the characters talk about horror and they dissect horror and they talk about other titles. And I remember even then watching Scream being like, ooh, what's this Nightmare on Elm Street? What's this Halloween that they all keep talking about? So I think that was what kind of birthed my love proper for the genre. And from that, I kind of branched off and sought out every horror movie I could find, basically.
Amazing. I love that answer. And you're the first person to say that Michael Jackson's Thriller was part of the birth of your like horror love. So I love that answer. That's just, like, fantastic. That's amazing. But actually that you mentioned there about Scream being a very good gateway for people into horror. And that kind of actually leads into one of the other questions that I have. Because again, my favorite thing about horror as a genre and the people who watch horror is everyone's like tastes as what they consider the perfect horror films are so different and wide, and it's one of my favorite things about it. So for yourself personally, and I'd imagine Scream will probably be one of them, but would you have like a list of films that you always recommend to someone who's like, say, has never watched horror and they're like, oh, I want to get into horror, which films should I watch? Like, do you have a list of films that you're like, okay, this is like your 10 commandments, watch these and then go from there?
I guess I would. My go-to would be those sort of the big ones, right? That are always on those best of lists. Like, I would say absolutely Scream, and actually if they're young, I would actually say go for slasher movies. I think if you're a young teenager wanting to get into horror, I would say go watch Halloween, go watch Black Christmas, go watch Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street. I would recommend those. But if I was just more broad, if there was just somebody, an adult or whoever, that wanted some horror recommendations, I would absolutely say Scream. I'd say Halloween. Then I would want to choose some sort of more kind of sci-fi. I would go Alien, right? I would go something classic and gothic, maybe The Haunting. And then I would go for something like something genuinely scary and kind of more, maybe something like The Blair Witch Project as well. Like, I feel like basically I tick off those big, big iconic, you know, every horror film, every horror fan must see these films, you know, like that kind of list. Ring, I would have the original, you know, Hideo Nakata's Ring on that list. I would have The Silence of the Lambs on that list as well, because I think, and you know, I'd want a mix of subgenres, because I think the fun of horror, and that's something that I definitely emphasize on my podcast, is that it's so broad. A movie set in a kind of gothic Transylvanian castle is so different to a movie like Lake Mungo or something. Like, you know, it's such a broad church. So I'd want a selection that shows the best of and the scope of what horror can do, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly, because that's the thing, horror is so expansive. And this is another segue into one of the other questions that I have, and it's quite hilarious because every time I ask this question on my own podcast in this series, I always preface it by saying I personally fall under the Mike Munster school of thinking of horror. So for yourself, would you have like personal criteria as to what you would consider to be a horror film, or is it more fluid and flux that you'd find ways to bring everything in?
Well, yeah, I am notoriously bad for, like, literally just this week as we're recording this, I've put Home Alone on my podcast, right? So which some people got a bit annoyed about, but I would cast a very, very broad net. I would say that how would I describe a horror movie? I think fundamentally it's a movie that is designed to make you feel uncomfortable, scared. It could be repulsed. Any of those kind of negative words. It's weird, isn't it? You know, I guess like if a comedy film is just designed to make you laugh. But a comedy film can be anything, right? You can have a comedy film set in space. It could be a Western. It could be a period drama. And horror is like that. I would say horror is more of a tone or a mood than it is anything else more specific, right? Some people say it's got to be supernatural to be horror, which is nonsense, I think, right? But yeah, I think it's more of a mood. I think if the film is designed to in some way make you feel uneasy, and uneasy is a big broad umbrella for lots of other terms, I would say, then it's a horror film. But there's not much that I would say isn't a horror film.
Exactly. Like, I know for myself, like, and I think we're on similar wavelengths in how we approach it, but for myself, I'm just like, I always like to say, oh, well, horror is my favorite genre, so I'll try and find to bring everything into it, because I'm just like, I don't watch other genres, I just watch horror. So if I watch a film and I like it, I'm like, I need to find a way to say it's horror or horror adjacent to justify my liking of it, which is just the way my brain works.
It's true. I'm exactly the same. I had that with Oppenheimer last week. I went to see Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer, and I was like, this is great. And I was like, actually, I think it's a bit of a horror film, actually. You know, probably no one else in the world said that. But yeah, I think I do exactly the same, for sure. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. But I think like a big... part of it, of like bringing it all in, how expansive and how everything could be considered horror in a different way as it is so multifaceted. But and I think also, just actually before I continue with this, I just want to say hats off on bringing Home Alone onto your show, because I was just like applauding, because yes, that was just a fantastic choice.
I mean, it's valid. It's home invasion, right? I think it's worth talking. It's one of the biggest grossing movies of all time. It's technically the biggest grossing home invasion movie of all time. I had to include it, right? It's important.
Yeah, 100%. But now I remember what my brain was going to say. But you were saying that with horror, like, so much of it is, as you said, it's a tone, it's a mood, it's about making people feel something, like some one of those broad negative emotions, but it's making someone feel something. And for me, I really personally like and I've used it so many times on this series, but it's because it's so relevant, but I really enjoy the quote from Joe Hill, Stephen King's son, where he says, you know, the foundation of horror isn't about creating fear, it's about creating empathy, as in you want to care for the people, what they're going through, otherwise it's not going to end up being effective in that sense. And I think that's why horror... we can look at something and say, oh yeah, that's horror, because we felt for what those characters were going
absolutely
through.
Because it made us feel something. And you know, all of us horror fans are lovely people, right, as well. That's the other thing, we do tend to be nice people with empathy. But I agree. And I think, you know, and of course there are a lot of horror films that are bad horror films, and I think at their worst they are movies that don't necessarily realize that the point of them is that they are about the empathy. They're not just about showing us buckets of blood or torture or whatever. I mean, that's all great too, but I think you've got to care about what you're seeing, you know, in order to be invested. And the best horror movies, like some of the ones I listed, those big ones, Alien, Blair Witch, whatever it might be, they're movies that have empathy for their characters and what they're going through, I think. And that is, you're absolutely right, that's key.
Exactly, 100%. And stemming from that, and I want to know what, like, your view on this is, but I think we'll both be very, again, similar wavelengths. But I see a lot of this on Twitter and, or X, as Elon Musk now wants to call it, whatever. But social media in general, but there tends to be this type of attitude of, like, people will say, you know, insert horror film name wasn't good because I wasn't scared. And I want to know for yourself, like, does a horror film need to be quote unquote scary to be considered good or effective?
Well, no, I don't think it does. Like, I'm very hard to scare these days because I've seen so much, right? So no, it would be a bit sad if I had to be scared by a movie now to like it. I would be left with very few movies left to like, right? So no, I don't necessarily think it has to be scary to be successful. I just think it needs to... I think it's like we said before, I think it still needs to try and put you in an uncomfortable place in some way or another. Whether or not you'd call that quote-unquote scary. Like, I don't know. It comes down to this idea of, you know, you maybe some films are designed to make you feel scared. Some horror films might more designed to kind of gross you out or repulse you. More of the abject than the uncanny, right? Some movies might be more to kind of make you feel uncomfortable. You know, I think of films like The Invitation and stuff. It's not kind of scary in a kind of boo way, but it's this kind of like feeling of discomfort and dread. So I think, you know, if you use the word scary as a very, very broad net to actually encompass all these other things that it's supposed to do, then I think actually, yes, I think it does need to do that, because otherwise what is horror, really?
Yeah, like
that is what it's supposed to do. But no, I don't agree with this opinion that it did not scare me, therefore it was not good. Like I think that's nonsense again, because there are all kinds of different emotions that a film can give you and a horror film can give you. But I do think that I need to feel something to enjoy a horror film. I'm definitely somebody that reacts better to movies that make me feel stuff. Like, I'm not so good with kind of filmmakers that might be extremely technically accomplished, but are quite cold, right? Or quite distant. And, you know, Wes Anderson is always the example I cite. You know, beautiful films, absolutely stunning. Like, the craft that goes into them are incredible, but I feel like they are like just kind of slightly empty, you know, other than sort of going, wow, what a beautifully framed symmetrical shot with lovely curtains and wallpaper. I'm not really invested in any other way in this story, right? Whereas in some ways I'd rather watch something that was cheap and scuzzy and didn't look as pretty but actually made me feel something, right? I think a good horror film has to make you feel something, but not necessarily just being scared.
Exactly. And also it comes back to it, and it shows, you know, being scared is such a subjective thing. You know, what one person can find absolutely terrifying and uncomfortable is completely different for the other. And actually, I really like what you prefaced your answer there by saying, you know, you've seen so much horror that not much scares you. And that's something that I like have picked up a lot with my conversations on this series, is that I think a lot of horror fans are, as well-intentioned as they are, they're kind of forgetting about everything they're bringing to the films they're watching. So it's kind of like they forget that they've seen so much horror that they have been a little bit desensitized. So, like, you know, when you think of, like, you know, blockbuster horror films, so, like, you know, The Insidiouses, The Conjuring, stuff like that, the ones that kind of rely on this predictable beats and jump scares and stuff, we as diehard horror fans, we can see them coming, we can appreciate, oh, you did that, but hey, it didn't really work the way you wanted it to. But someone who doesn't watch horror for a living, or just because nothing else is entertaining, goes into that film, will find it petrifying. And I just wish more horror fans were like aware of what they're bringing into these films.
Oh, totally. And like, some of those films I am all for, you know, like going into the cinema and having James Wan or Lee Whannell just really scare the shit out of me for 90 minutes. And they still do those films because they're, you know, they have so many jump scares and all of that kind of thing. And again, I think there's something about us, and I'm guilty of this too, that kind of almost take against those sorts of Ghost Train movies that just keep making you jump. And I don't know why, because actually they're very good at making those sorts of films, and there is a real craft in executing a really good scare, and those films do that. But yes, I think we definitely do get a bit jaded as horror fans. And actually, when you look at the movies that we do all gush over, they are the ones that are scary. So, like, right now, everyone is talking about Talk to Me. Have you seen Talk to Me? Yeah.
Not yet. It's on my list. It's hard excellent. To get in our cinemas here.
Right. Yeah. It's a nightmare because it's competing with Barbie and everything at the moment as well. So, like, there's not many showings of it. But it's excellent. Everyone who I've spoken to has loved it. It's like most people's horror film of the year so far. And it's genuinely scary. And that's one of the things that people keep saying. They're like, oh, it's actually scary. And I think so, even though I've said, you know, they don't have to be scary to be good, when you look at the movies over recent years that we celebrate the most, Hereditary, The Witch, they are scary movies. So I think it doesn't have to be scary to be a great horror movie, but I think if you do manage to scare us horror fans, that elevates it to a whole new level, doesn't it, I think?
Yeah. Exactly, 100%. And I think that comes back to, again, like the, you know, being aware of what you're bringing into the films you engage with. It's also like, you know, when you're watch, like you said, like the, you know, Scream, you watch that, you know, at 11, and the way it made you feel, like the first time you experienced a film like that, that's what all of us horror fans are doing. We're seeking that first experience. And like the thing is, it's going to be nigh on impossible to repeat the exact same first experience. So when we get something that brings us as close to it, that's why those are the films that we gush over and celebrate, because it made us feel like we did the first time we watched horror. And like, again, that's why I just, like, you know, even though I very much loathe the internet phrase, let people enjoy things, at the, at the same time, I do wish that, you know, if someone says, oh, I found, you know, mainstream horror film very scary, like, you'll see so many comments from people going, it wasn't really that scary. And I'm just like, just let them have that first baby fear just because it didn't do it for you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's so true. And, you know, what I love too about horror is that there are different types of scare, you know, and that's something, you know, like when you're young and you're watching teen slasher movies like Scream or Halloween, there's something about that that feels like quite a safe scare. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's a great scary experience, but it's something about it feels quite safe. And then you watch movies like, you know, Martyrs or something, and that is a less safe scare in some way, right? And there's the fear that you feel watching The Blair Witch Project is a very different fear to what you feel when you watch, you know, a slasher movie or whatever. And it's like, I think that's really interesting too, is that there are different types of kind of fear that we feel depending on the subgenre and everything, you know?
100%. And the way the different subgenres make us feel, like, I know for myself, for example, like body horror is the one type of subgenre that is always going to squick me out just because it makes you feel so uncomfortable. But also as, like, you know, a transgender non-conforming person, horror in the body feels more situated for me because it's part of how I exist in the world. And, you know, so that's why, that's what I always find so fascinating in talking to different horror fans who are bringing their own unique perspectives to horror, because it's just like, what makes horror work for that individual person? It's one of my favorite things. It's why I've loved this series, having these conversations with everyone. But moving on a little bit, this next question, and it's kind of something we've been touching on a little bit, coming back to, you know, what people find scary and stuff like that. And I have, like, you know, noticed that there does seem to be this type of attitude of, like, a certain type of horror fan that bemoans the state of modern horror and says there's no such thing as good horror anymore. And I want to know, like, where do you think that attitude is coming from?
I don't know, right? I could, because I could not disagree more with that sentiment. And you're absolutely right. There are a lot of horror fans. I don't want to put them in a box, but they do tend to be middle-aged cis men.
Yeah.
Who grew up on, let's say, 70s and 80s, you know, splatter movies, body horror, giallo, you know, that, like, the kind of video nasty stuff, who think that horror has gotten too soft, too clean, I don't know, and almost too, like, high and mighty and elitist as well. Like, there's this other thing that's been happening in recent years, you know, this awful term that we all hate, like this kind of elevated horror thing that's been happening recently, where, you know, these movies that are just a really well-made, well-written horror movies with stuff to say and stuff to explore are somehow being sort of, you know, for people outside of the horror genre, they're being appreciated, but they're sort of like, oh, we love these movies, but they're better than horror, right? They're like something else. And then within horror, there are certain people, like those kind of bros that love 70s and 80s movies, who also take against them, and they're like, hashtag not my horror movies, like, you know, Hereditary and The Witch and Get Out and these films that are, you know, I don't know, in this new wave of kind of, you know, sort of slightly more socially conscious horror films or something that we've had. And again, it's not a new thing. That's something we've had forever in horror. But I guess there've been quite an overt wave of them in the last decade. And that for some reason it riles people up, doesn't it? I don't understand why. There are, you know, people on Twitter and certain quite big horror personalities that have vocally sort of said, oh, stop putting such overt politics into horror movies. And it's nonsense. They've always been there, you know. So, and it goes in waves. It really goes in waves, because during the 2000s, this is one of the things that I look at a lot in my podcast, like mm-hmm. this kind of evolution and how it changes from decade to decade. And it is always cyclical, because I find that in the 2000s, horror went quite nasty again.
Yeah.
And went a little bit more bro-y, and I'm not, and some of them are still great, you know. I love some of the stuff that came out of the 2000s, but it definitely is this school of filmmakers, Rob Zombie, Eli Roth, etc., mm-hmm. that grew up watching 70s grindhouse movies and just wanted to bring that back, you know, like bring us back to the heyday of when everything was a bit more scuzzy and exploitative. And so we got that kind of wave of nasty stuff, and then it flipped back the other way into the 2010s, and it's doing something a little bit different and maybe slightly more thought-provoking. And yeah, it's funny, isn't it, that even within horror there are different audiences that kind of rally against each other, yeah, in terms of different types of horror that they enjoy, you know. It's so funny.
Exactly. Yeah. And as you said, you don't want to put these people in a box, but the fact that most of them seem to be middle-aged cis men, they're speaking 100%. For themselves. But again, I think it's also, like, you know, to be, I guess, favorable to these people that probably don't need favoritism, but I think it comes back, like, again, it's chasing that nostalgia. Like, as in, yes, they would have, as you said, they've grown up with those films. So those were the films that, like, because our tastes when it comes to music, film, whatever, it's what is developed in our teenage years, our formative years. It's, yeah, what we experience at those ages that makes it become, like, a part of our personality in a way. And
absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
So I can understand where it's just like, what is being made now doesn't reflect what they got when they were teenagers. So it feels different and new and weird. But I'm also just like, embrace it. Like, yeah, more newness, more weirdness is better. Like, the more type of different perspectives that are telling these stories is exciting. And I think that's ultimately what it is, as you said. It's also, and this is something, and I want to know what you actually think about this. Like, I do think part of the criticism that is, I guess, thrown at these quote-unquote elevated horror films is that, like, a lot of the messaging and stuff like that is too on the nose or too textual, because, as you said, horror films have always been so commentating on society, but it was more subtextual, it was more nuanced. Yeah. But yeah, that was mainly because they had to be to get past censors, whereas now you can be a bit more open and you can have people of color in main roles or queer, yeah, people in main roles. But I want to know, like, do you think there's a problem if a film's messaging is too on the nose, to say, or does it depend on the film and what they're trying to achieve?
Well, I don't actually think that having a message that's on the nose is a bad thing, as long as it's not in detriment to the story it's telling. Yes. Because I think my favorite horror movie of the last decade is Jordan Peele's Get Out. Mm-hmm. Now, that is not a subtle, that is not a subtle movie, no, in its subtext and its messaging, right? Like, it is on the nose, yeah, but it's also a masterpiece, right? It's actually telling a brilliant story. It's a really fun movie. It's a crowd pleaser. It, you know, raucous audiences at the cinema watched that film. It was so much fun. It's laugh out loud funny. It's scary, but it's also very, very smart and has something to say. And it says it loud and clear. So I don't actually think it's a problem at all if the message is on the nose, providing that it doesn't affect the actual storytelling. For me, like, I think the worst examples of these sorts of films are the ones that maybe that they're so concentrating on the message that they forget to actually give us a good story with characters and, again, make me feel something, I suppose. So it's a tricky balance to, yeah, get. But I don't want to be one of those people, like we've just talked about, who says, oh, the messaging is too on the nose, because I don't think that's an issue when it's done well. Again, Jordan Peele's movies, their messaging is pretty clear, but they're, yep, still great movies, right? So yeah, I think it's where, you know, there are a few examples that are not so great in recent years. There was a new The Craft movie. There was a new Black Christmas. Like, some of these movies are, they're, I admire them for what they're trying to do, I just think that maybe they just needed like a couple more drafts of a script to kind of get that story a bit better. Do you know what I mean?
100%. And I'd be in agreement there that it's just like, you know, if the story and everything around it is so well done that you almost like forget how like much you're being hit with a sledgehammer of social messaging, that's the perfect balance. And it is hard to get it. That's why the ones that are good stand out for being so good.
Totally. And actually, even when the message is, you know, even when these movies have like not great messages, you know, that's fine too. Make me feel something. Make me feel uncomfortable. Maybe make me feel a bit dirty for liking this movie that is maybe a bit problematic in certain ways. Like, that's fine. Like, we don't want anything to be too wholesome and too safe. That's not the 100%. Point of horror, right? As well. So I think it's such a tricky balance to get. And I think it comes down to the writing, you know. So as with any genre, there are good examples of these sorts of films and bad examples, you know.
Exactly, 100%. And I love that you said it's like, you know, we don't want things to be too wholesome or too safe, like, you know. And that's the same way I feel about just general kind of like queer representation in horror. Like, you know, so much of the type of queer representation we get is all about, you know, giving us like safe, happy stories, and I'm just like, no, I want like realistic, messy queers. Like, I want my queer slashers. Like, you know, I want the like the queer villains, but not because they're queer, they just happen to be queer, and they're what was the film, even though it wasn't made for the two lesbian characters, but it ended up working, Canadian one, I can't remember it, but
yeah, there's a few, isn't there? Is that the one where they go on a honeymoon, or is that a
one? They go on the honeymoon, and like one of them ends up just being a sadistic weirdo.
Brilliant. That's such a good film, so much fun. And you're absolutely right, it's not necessarily a movie about queerness in that regard, right? It is just, although that's fine too, but it's like, it's fine, but we can have all these things, right? Let's have all these different things. Yeah.
100%. But actually picking up on something you kind of said earlier, and it leads into another question I have. But you kind of mentioned how, as we said, there is this type of generation of horror fan that grew up with the kind of 70s and 80s, like splatter and exploitation, where things were a lot more quote unquote tits and ass and stuff like that. But, over the last while, I have noticed in general that, I guess, most of our media, like the films and TV that we're getting, seems to be like very sanitized and desexualized. Yeah. And like horror seems to be the only genre that, I guess, is still kind of rejecting that and is like kind of refusing to go down that route. But I want to know like what you think. Do you think this is like just happens to be a coincidence because horror has always been more subversive, or do you feel like it's a deliberate reaction that people who are making horror are like, no, we're not going to become puritanical like the rest of you guys?
Well, it's really difficult because actually I think I would say that actually even horror has become a little bit it's more like, obviously horror is still transgressive when it comes to gore and violence, but I think when it comes to sex, I think it has gotten a bit cleaner actually, you know, like I think it has become a bit sanitized, and it's such a hard thing, like it's a really hard, and I'm very aware of myself as like a cis man saying, why aren't there more tits and ass on films, right? Like it's a hard, like it's such a tricky balance, because I do think that it's sad that we don't get films anymore like the erotic thrillers of the 80s and 90s. Like we just don't get that stuff anymore. I think a perfect example, actually a recent example, is there was a new Hellraiser film that came out, and this Hellraiser film was like fine, it was pretty good, but it was, as my friend Anna Bogutskaya from the Final Girls put it perfectly, where she described it as very missionary, right? And it is, it's not that. Hellraiser is a film that is supposed to be transgressive,
exactly,
and you go, oh my god, I'm kind of really turned on slash scared by this movie, and it's kind of grimy and sexy and scary and weird and gross. And it's all of those things, and that's what the point of it is, right? This film about kind of pain and pleasure and desire. And this latest one was not that, you know? No. It isn't that. And I think that is a perfect example of the times, you know, when you look at the original Hellraiser and you look at the 2021 Hellraiser, I think, sadly, horror even has become a bit sanitized. Maybe that's going to change, but, you know, again, look at the big big hitters of the last decade. It follows the Babadook, Hereditary, all the Conjuring movies. Like, they are very clean in a way, you know. So it's and I'm they're all good films, but I think sex has disappeared a bit from the horror genre. Yeah.
Exactly, actually, yeah, no, the more I think about it, I guess, like, maybe it was in my brain, I was just like, no, I don't want to believe horror has been affected as well.
I know.
It's so true.
Yeah, obviously you get a lot of kind of slightly more off-the-beaten-track stuff, and, you know, you get great filmmakers like Lars von Trier and Julia de Corno, and they're, you know, like, international film is still super sexy and cool and weird, but I think I guess I'm talking about American and British horror. I think it is following that trend of slightly sanitized.
I think so too, and especially as, like, you know, given that it may, you know, the fact that Ty West's X stood out because it was doing something that so other films were, but no, like, I personally, like, and this is something that I'm constantly, like, you know, philosophizing on with this series, but I personally think that it's because of, like, the advent of social media. Like, our social media is governed by these massive American tech firms, which are very PC, puritanical, and kind of like, we can't have any form of, like, nudity or sexuality unless you're a famous celebrity in a straight side body. And I think that's it's like this weird kind of everything's feeding into each other. That's everything we're seeing socially, and that ends up feeding into the media we get. And then it's a cycle. And I'm just like, I don't know how we can break out of it. Cause like, it's that fine balance. It's like, you don't want to go back to the male gazy, very misogynistic 80s films. But we also want, you know, sex isn't a bad thing.
Yeah, you want sex positive horror. And actually, you were right about X. Like, that's a great example of a movie that does break that mold. You know, Ty West is still doing really cool things. I guess his movies are still that little bit more niche and indie, aren't they?
They're not exactly.
But you're absolutely right about that. But yes, you're right. It's this weird, I think it's this perfect storm that's happened where in the last 10 years, there have been a lot of positive changes, right?
Yeah.
In that, you know, people are now being called out on, you know, the way that women have been treated, the way minorities have been treated, the way queer people have been treated. And so, but then the knock-on effect of that is that, people online become kind of judge, jury, and executioners about certain behavior or certain things that are said. Mm-hmm. And it starts off with the right intentions and then it can get skewed, can't it, I think? And what happens is that sometimes, like, you know, if I'm just going to use broad terms like the left and the right here to talk about this. But, like, sometimes the progressive left can become as judgmental as the kind of evangelical right when it comes to, like, sex or whatever, you know, and it's like, oh, no, what's happened here? And then that paired with the kind of corporate Disneyfication of everything, of course, you know, has I think both of those things. You're absolutely right. It's social media. And it's the kind of corporatization of everything in the last decade has really led to this point that we're at now.
Yeah, it's like, and speaking of, like, the corporatization of everything, I'm just like, you know, seeing those headlines of, like, you know, Greta Gerwig, like, becomes first woman to, like, make $1 billion on a film, which is like, that's amazing. But it's also, it's a film for a corporation, which means that they're not going to learn the right lesson, which means we're in for 20 years of different toy spin-off films, which is like, that's not what the lesson is.
It's all that means now is we're going to get, like, a Mr. Potato Head, the movie and stuff. Like, it's not, but, you know, I there's a good and bad to that, isn't there? I think if they keep doing what, because it's going to happen, you're absolutely right, we're going to get loads of toy spin-offs now, but if they keep hiring cool voices like
and allow them to
make
just
them
have their vision
of, smuggle in this kind of weird subversive satire into these corporate movies, like you mentioned, like filmmakers had to do back in the day, like you'd have to kind of, like, Trojan horse your kind of cool weird satire and subversive and sexy themes into these movies that are quite heavily, you know, censored or whatever, then I guess that's the best we can hope for, isn't it, really?
Exactly. But also, like, before I go into my next question, which is going to be another great segue because it's going to be about censorship, because you just mentioned it there, but before I jump into that, maybe it's another good example, like, you know, we're talking about the films feel so desexualized and very sanitized and clean over the last number of years. Maybe a big part of that is the fact that there's very few women and queer people behind the camera making films, it tends to be still just straight men making films, and they don't want to be seen to have sex on screen because it's a straight man, you know. And it's just like, well, maybe the answer is make different people make films and things will feed into each other.
You're absolutely right. That is exactly the thing. And that is why I think we do see more sex and transgression in some of these movies that are made by women, minorities, queer people, like, again, Julia De Corno, who made Raw and Titan, which are these incredibly weird, transgressive, gross, sexy, brilliant movies, right? And you're absolutely right about that. Like, that is, that's the ultimate problem, really. It's, that's the ultimate problem with the system, is that it's still too many men making these films who are, with the best of intentions, I think, very aware now and are like, oh, I'm not going to put sex in my movie because I'm a cis man, but it means that they're the only people making films, so we don't get anything anything out of the ordinary.
It all feeds into each other. It all feeds into each other. But like, but yes, and then that you mentioned about like how people have to Trojan horse things because of censorship, and that leads into this other question which I have, which I think is something that every horror fan has had to have this internal debate about the media we engage with. But for yourself, like, you know, how do you feel about censorship? Like, do you, would you say there is a line as into what is acceptable to be portrayed on screen in cinema, film, horror, or is it like allowing any form of censorship is just like a gateway to more and more control? Like, what do you think?
My instinct is absolutely to say no, blanket no to all censorship, right? Like, I really, really, really I'm strongly against censorship. I really find troubling this kind of, again, this kind of new sort of Disney-vocation of censoring kind of historic stuff or pulling things or putting things in their vault that are now, you know, like movies like Song of the South. It's like, no. Don't just hide that away. I think we all need to acknowledge that those sorts of movies existed and just, you know, show it with the caveat of, you know, what this movie includes.
Exactly.
Right?
Like, we made a mistake when this was made, but we still should be aware of those mistakes type thing.
Very much so. I think it's really important, actually. I think censorship is genuinely dangerous when it comes to that kind of thing. And, you know, when it comes to like a line, do I have a line? And it's a really interesting conversation I had that I'll never forget with one of the guests on my podcast a few years ago, the great Charlie Albright, because we were talking about movies like a Serbian film and stuff like that, and these movies that are very, very extreme. And, you know, and I always said, and I said to him, I said, I'm basically anti-censorship unless there is real, genuine harm to animals or people on screen, and in which case, you can get rid of it. I don't really want to look at it. But he made the really good point where he said to me, yeah, but what, define harm, because look at what, you know, for example, Tippi Hedren went through in Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds, right? Like abuse and harm towards people, women, whatever, has existed in all guises. Look at Shelley Duvall in The Shining. Like, look at, like, so where do we draw the line? Like, there has always been abuse and harm towards people or whatever on screen, and so it's really interesting, and it's a really difficult thing, and so I think over time I've kind of changed my mind even on that, where I think if that film, for example, Cannibal Holocaust, a movie that famously has a really gross, really horrible, uncomfortable scene in which an animal is really violently killed on screen, a turtle, a beautiful giant turtle is basically kind of like gutted and killed on screen. And everyone has different opinions on this. And I think there's a Blu-ray available now where you can choose to watch it in either way. You can choose to watch it with that scene kept in, or you can choose to watch the version that doesn't have it included. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the best way now. Like, I've kind of changed my mind a bit. I think a few years ago I might have said, cut that scene out. Actually, I think I've gone the other way now, and I think make people aware that it's in it, and let it be our choice. If we want to watch that for, you know, historical reasons, sometimes there are, you know, you want to see the film that the filmmaker actually intended. And even if it really is horrible, maybe there's a reason for that. And, you know, maybe it's important. But equally, if you don't want to watch a fucking turtle get gutted on screen, then also you can have that choice to watch the censored version. So I am basically anti-censorship, and I think every consumer, every audience member should be allowed to watch whatever they want, as long as they are aware of if they're watching something that's going to have something harmful in it, and they sort of know the context behind it, I guess.
Yeah, I think ultimately that's the best way to put it. Because, like, you know, also, as I said, like, censorship being a gateway type thing, if we allow censorship in some ways to say, oh, we don't think that's, you know, applicable or safe for these people, then, you know, that's like a gateway to basically full-on fascism, which we're getting in Florida with banning books. That's censorship. That's them saying, oh, we don't think you should know our actual history on slavery and racism, or about queer people's lived realities. That's censorship. So yeah, I'm very much the same in that I tend to be like anti-censorship, but allow people to make those informed decisions. Like, that's why I love, like, the concept of trigger warnings and stuff like that, because, like, you know, put those in front so people can decide, oh, if I watch this, you know, is my past trauma going to be triggered?
Yeah.
I need to know that. You know, it's an empathy thing. That's what I think is the best way. Allow people to make those informed decisions. But ultimately, allowing censorship in one way is a slippery slope to something we don't want to go to.
Completely agree. Yeah, I think basically it's a very easy blanket no answer to censorship, essentially, right? And especially these days, you know, it's so much harder now to see a film that will get a mainstream release that would have anything genuinely harmful in it as well. So actually what we're talking about, again, going back to sort of, let's say, movies with real kind of animal harm or whatever, those are likely to be older movies.
Yes.
And, you know, thankfully we won't get that so much anymore, you know. So I think it's all in the context, right? It's all about the context of when these films were made and how you view them and what you know about them going in, like you said.
100%, exactly. Yeah. And actually, you mentioned earlier about the filmmaker's intent, and I think that leads into this other question, which is another one that I think is really interesting. And it is something, again, you know, even listening to, like, your podcast, like, this conversation has come up so many times. Mm. But, like, I want to know, like, do you think, like, say, the concept of, like, say, the death of the author applies to horror films, in that, like, you know, the filmmaker, like, you know, they have their intent, and then once the film is out there, does their intention still matter, or is it more in the hands of the viewer? And I think linked to that, and I guess maybe overlapping with censorship, is also the whole, like, again, very difficult topic which every horror fan has to reconcile with, but the whole art versus artist, you know.
Yeah.
Can you have that separation? But I want to know what you think about that, like, as in the sense that, is there such a thing as you shouldn't engage with media attached to problematic people because their vision, what they put out there, is linked to a problematic person?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's such a difficult topic. And it's one that, like you said, I have had a lot over the last few years, because you have to, right?
Yeah.
You do bump into these sorts of dilemmas when you're talking about brilliant and historically important horror movies. And it's like, right, are we going to talk about Rosemary's Baby? Are we going to talk about, you know, Roman Polanski? Are we going to celebrate his films? Are we going to encourage more people to go out and find and watch these films and support these filmmakers that have done monstrous things or whatever? Ultimately, again, having thought about this and talked about this a lot over the last few years, I fall down personally on, I can separate the art from the artist. I am very much a believer in the death of the author.
Yeah.
I believe that films are made by hundreds of people most of the time, who are all putting in amazing work. And I think it's unfair that one bad apple will ruin it, you know? However, I wouldn't blame somebody for not wanting to watch that stuff. Again, I feel like it all comes down to your choice. I think what's bad is when we start to blame, or, I don't know, kind of like chastise people for wanting to watch a Woody Allen film or a, you know, whatever. It's really hard. Like, I don't know. I was talking about this with my friend Becky yesterday at the pub, because at the time we're recording this, earlier this week, Kevin Spacey has just been acquitted of a whole bunch of, you know, allegations. And it's hard because, like, we sort of said, well, we sort of want to believe in the system, and we sort of want to believe that if that's the case, you know, can we go back to sort of talking about what a brilliant actor he is again, right? And but it's hard. Everyone has to make their own decisions with what they're comfortable with, I think, ultimately. But I do think that I am very much able to separate the art from the artist. And it's hard with certain, it's hard, for example, this is not horror, but it's hard with Woody Allen, I think, because I personally find Woody Allen films a bit uncomfortable because he casts himself in the main roles and he writes movies about him having affairs with underage girls. Like Manhattan is literally about him having an affair with an underage teenage girl. And it's like, I find that a bit uncomfortable to watch. Now, that is just my personal choice. I would never, ever judge anyone else for loving his movies and, you know, watching his movies, because I get it. Like, everyone can, I think as a consumer, you can enjoy any art you want, you know. Yeah. I haven't sexually assaulted anybody. I can watch whatever films I want, thanks, you know. Like, I don't know. I just feel like I don't like this climate of us blaming each other, I suppose, for 100%. Awful things that awful people have done, you know. So it's hard, but I think we should be able to enjoy whatever art we want. And again, where do you draw the line? Like, what Alfred Hitchcock did to women, what Stanley Kubrick did to his actors. There are monstrous people in all kinds of art, you know, going back to painters, Renaissance painters, right? So it's like, where do you draw the line if you want to start boycotting stuff, you know?
Exactly.
So it's really difficult.
And I think that, you know, as you said, there's been problematic people since the start of art because there are problematic people. Like, there's no such, you know, like, if your personal line is I'm not going to engage with anything made by problematic people, well, that's going to cut out a lot of what you can engage with. But also, as you said, it's where is the line, in the sense that, for example, Harvey Weinstein, you know, he isn't in Scream or any of those Scream films, but his studio financed it. Do you say, oh, I'm not going to watch anything associated with Harvey Weinstein? Well, that's a lot of important horror films that you can't engage with now. It's a tricky one. Like, ultimately, for me, it's something I'm always flip-flopping on, but I think I always tend to land back down on the side of, it comes back to allowing people to make those informed choices. They can choose for themselves what they want to engage with, but also, people need to have that acknowledgement, in the sense that it's like, you know, on a podcast, if you're having an episode where you're talking about, for some, if you want to, for some reason, talk about, you know, Jeepers Creepers and Victor Salva, you know, you make sure that you acknowledge that we are aware of the problematic, you know, history associated with this director, and then go forward. You know, like, I think that's acknowledging the harms and then engaging with it is the important thing, rather than just saying I don't care. That's the difference. And I think you can tell when someone isn't, like, with how someone's engaging with it, you know, where they're coming from. And, you know, I try, like yourself, I try not to judge and stuff like that, but for me, there's a difference between, as you said, engaging with a historical piece of media like Rosemary's Baby or some films like that that are attached to people that have a problematic past, versus I'm going to continue financially supporting the person and I'm aware of their harms. Because I think there is a big difference, you know. So that's why if I see, like, you know, I had Brad Hansen on the show the other week, and you know, he talked about, oh, I'm not going to be a fan of Venice because they are having Woody Allen and Polanski films. You know, so it's just kind of like, I'm going to be giving a bit of a side eye, because I'm like, if you choose to work with someone and it's well common that they have a problematic past that's been confirmed, I'm gonna side eye you.
Yeah, totally, totally. And I absolutely. I agree with that too. And I would not go see a new Roman Polanski movie or Woody Allen movie. You're absolutely right about that. And actually, again, it comes down to more of a systemic kind of problem. There is that. Why are they still being given millions of dollars to make movies, right? Stop it. Exactly. Because, like, give these chances to people that haven't raped somebody or whatever, you know.
But another, like, the more when I remember finding this out, it just, like, blew my mind in the worst possible way. But the simple fact that Victor Salva made Jeepers Creepers after having done his crime. Like, it wasn't like something he made the film, nobody knew about it, and then it, like...
No, it
was known, and...
it's a really difficult thing, and again, everyone has their own line.
Exactly,
100%. Some people choose to only watch the films that were made before people have committed their crimes. Like, for example, you know, people have made that argument to me that they don't mind watching Repulsion and Rosemary's Baby, but they don't like watching anything post Roman Polanski's, you know, transgressions in the movies that he made in the sort of mid-70s onwards. And it's, I get it. I get, like, again, I think everyone has to make their own decision there in what they choose to do. And you're right, it's really, really, really troubling that, you know, Victor Salva went on to make this movie about this kind of monster that preys on young boys. Like, I mean, it's really weird. It's almost like he was kind of mockingly making this film after having done what he did. It's very strange in all kinds of ways. But yeah, he was able to go out and make it, and people worked with him. And I, you know, it's hard. Yeah, it's
so hard. And like, but again, it's like we both said, it's like, where is the line? Because it's just like, yeah, there is unfortunately so many problematic, abusive people in positions of power making media. So it's, yeah, there's no easy answer. I think ultimately it comes back to, as we both said, allow people to make those choices for themselves, and that's all you can do, really, because you don't want to get into that position which ends up becoming censorship again, of dictating what someone can do. And exactly, that's what we don't want to do. But I think, as a last kind of like a question to kind of possibly round us out for this chat, for yourself, and I probably would know one or two of them anyway because you've mentioned them, but like, what are your comfort films from the horror genre? Like, as in, if you've had a shit day, which films do you turn on because you just know you're going to have a good time with it?
Oh, man. It's a good question, actually. Yeah, there are so many. Scream is obviously one that springs to mind, absolutely. Black Christmas is like, I don't have many films that I watch a lot. Like, some people have their kind of like one film that they watch every year on Halloween or whatever. I don't actually have that, but I do watch Black Christmas 1974 every Christmas. Like, that is a very comforting movie to me. I absolutely love it. The Silence of the Lambs is a great sort of comfort watch for me. Sort of Stephen King stuff I find quite comforting as well, you know, like even some of the sort of made for TV stuff like Salem's Lot, and there's something kind of warm and comforting and Sunday afternoon about it, you know, like Mike Flanagan's Dr. Sleep, I have that with as well. Like, I'm very happy to just like sink onto the sofa and watch 3 hours of Dr. Sleep. I love it so much. So I find that very a comfort watch. And it's funny, isn't it? Because horror shouldn't really be comforting.
So I know, it's such an oxymoron.
Yeah. And a good, like, and a good gothic ghost story as well. Like a movie like The Others or The Orphanage or The Innocents. These are all like comfort watches for me as well, I think. It's something about watching movies set in cold spaces that I find quite comforting, you know? Like The Thing, and I don't know. There's something about it, like watching like snowy cold movies. I find like curling up on the sofa and watching those quite comforting, you know.
Exactly. And I think it's like, I'm like, of all a lot of those films that you've kind of listed off, like great ones, but I think as well, it a lot of those kind of fall into the guise of being like, you know, almost like character studies in a way, like in, you know, they're films that have really fleshed out characters that have something happening to them, you know, because like, don't get me wrong, I love like most of the slashers as much as the next person, but like so many of the slasher films, they're not about the people. They're just about how are we going to see these stereotypes get killed off one by one.
Like, absolutely. And... yeah, absolutely. It does not matter who these people are. We just want to see how they get beheaded or whatever. Yeah.
Perfect. And actually, one last question, which I'm going to actually quickly ask before we close out, because it kind of stemming from that, because it just popped into my head. But something that I think is quite a common phrase to horror fans is the whole type of thing of, like, you know, so bad it's good. And it's something that I think becomes comfort watches for a lot of people. But for me, I think there's a diff, you know, so bad it's good is like almost used in a way for people who don't want to admit that they enjoyed something. So they say it was so bad it's good.
Yeah.
And I've seen that apply to, say, Malignant or Old or a lot of these films. And like, for me, I think it's a misunderstanding of what camp horror is, as in, like, you know, people don't want to admit that they enjoyed something that knew what it was doing, and they want to say it's bad, therefore it was good. And I just want to know quickly what you think about that. Do you, because, like, again, as you said earlier, that something that you notice doing your show is that horror goes in cycles, as in like each era of horror influences the next, and that's a conversation with each era. And now a lot of the new horror we're getting seems to be very much leaning into camp and being out there and ridiculous, because we did have a previous decade of very serious commentary films, and now we're getting a reaction to that. But I want to know what you think about that. Do you think that there would be a difference between camp films and So Bad It's Good horror?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that, like, I do tend to kind of like recoil a bit at the phrase "so bad it's good."
Yeah, I know.
And I'm not personally somebody that does gravitate towards just like bad horror movies. Yeah. I know people get a real pleasure out of this, you know. Like you mentioned Brad Hansen. Brad has got that kind of thing. Like, he loves the Wicker Man remake with Nick Cage and stuff. I don't really get it. I for me, a bad movie is just a bad movie.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. I think there is a difference when it's a movie that has a kind of camp quality to it. This is just my subjective opinion, but I also didn't love Malignant very much. And I felt like it was a kind of cynical So Bad It's Good movie. Like, I felt like it was trying to be a So Bad It's Good movie, right? And for therefore, I don't really warm to it. Whereas Old, I loved it. And this is just my own sensibility, but I don't think that Old is so bad it's good. I don't think it was trying to be bad. I think it was earnest. Yeah. And I think, and then, so there's a lot of it that sounds quite funny and weird because M. Night Shyamalan is such a weird writer. And because it takes its subject matter seriously, it comes across as so bad it's good. And I think that movie is camp, right? I think for me, camp is not, I don't know, I feel like it's never deliberate. I feel like you shouldn't be setting out to make something that is camp. I feel like that goes against what camp is. I might be wrong. And I feel like this is a kind of, you know, everyone kind of has their own view really on this kind of thing. But I am not a fan of movies that set out to be camp, you know, so bad they're good movies, because there's something in it that is quite cynical, I think, and therefore goes against what camp is. I don't know. Like, whereas when you go back to some of these older, weirder movies, I don't know, Sleepaway Camp, for example, or, you know, obviously some John Waters movies. I don't know. But there are these other movies that are really like setting out to do something and tell a story. And then sometimes, you know, they come across as kind of absurd or out there or bad, but they are taking what they're doing seriously.
Yes.
That to me is camp. And that to me is the stuff that I like. It's the stuff that is setting out to be a so bad it's good movie or a camp classic that I think negates it from being a camp classic. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense. And again, as you said, it's such a nuanced topic, and you could have an entire podcast series just depicting that topic. It's so subversive. But I think for me, like, I've just never liked that phrase "so bad it's good" in the same way that I don't like the phrase "guilty pleasure," because it's like, it's almost like it comes back to this like societal Catholicism and cultural shame that, you know, we're not supposed to admit that we enjoy pleasurable things or that something gave us pleasure. Like, I think that's where it comes from. But yeah, I think there is a difference between a film that's like, as you said, earnest and is setting out to just tell a story and be a film, and then through a like weird domino effect, it ends up like failing miserably in a beautiful way. Or a film that's like, oh no, we want to capture that energy. We're going to try and do it. And we're going to make lots of in jokes and, you know, we're winking at the camera. And I think there's a subtle difference. But yeah, it's such a, again, it's such a subversive topic. But yes, that's, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a really enjoyable conversation, and I've just loved the way everything has flowed. So just before I let you go, for people who may not know where to find you, where can people find you and your work? And if there's any events coming up you want to plug,
Thank you. Yeah, so you can find Evolution of Horror wherever you get your podcasts. I'm on all these bloody socials now.
On
Threads, Blue Sky, Twitter, X, whatever it is, Instagram, Facebook. If you've got a social media platform, you can probably just search for me. So I'm Mike Munzer, and the podcast is The Evolution of Horror. I'm on most of the socials where you can follow us. And yeah, we do events as well. We do screening events around the UK. Sadly, I really want to come to Ireland actually at some point, but like a lot of them at the moment are just kind of sort of England and Scotland, but we've got stuff coming up in Manchester and Leeds and York and Edinburgh and a whole bunch of places around October for spooky month. So loads of stuff like that that we've got going on. So all kind of details of that kind of stuff you can find on our website, evolutionofhorror.com.
Amazing. Thank you so much for coming on. And to my listeners, thank you so much for listening to every episode in this series. I've really appreciated it. And keep eyes and ears peeled for future episodes.